We consider an encounter between McDowell and Putnam. And you might think that what we saw there, I'll put it in a way that might seem to be right. Do you know what I said? When we were looking at that. You might think you could draw the following conclusion. Putnam's primarily interested in Cartesian skepticism. McDowell thinks the important kinds of skepticism is Kantian skepticism. Putnam misreads McDowell by construing his problematic to be a Cartesian. When he comes across a phrase like, our cognitive powers cannot reach the objects themselves, he gives a Cartesian constraint to that. So he misses what Putnam's saying, because he feels to realize that that sentence and a great deal of other vocabulary are inflected in a Kantian register. So this might lead you to conclude something more general. Like, here's how you go wrong reading McDowell. You take his vocabulary to be working in a Cartesian register when it's really working in a Kantian register. That's my first reminder. Plus a possible summary of what we've learned. Second reminder is, more recently, last class, we looked at an encounter between Kripke and Cavell. It might look like you could summarize that encounter like this. The kind of skepticism that Kripke is really interested in is Kantian skepticism. Cavell is interested in Cartesian skepticism. So Cavell tries to argue that the problem that Kripke attributes to Wittgenstein, in which Kripke assumes Wittgenstein's interested in it, is neither in Wittgenstein nor a form of skepticism, by arguing that it doesn't have any of the earmarks of Cartesian skepticism. And you might conclude from that, generalizing a bit from that one sample. So here's a way in which Cavell's going to misread people. When Cavell reads people that have Kantian interests, he's going to mislead them the way Putnam did, by assuming that, the way Putnam misread McDowell on that occasion, by assuming that they must have a Cartesian shape, if there's a good issue here. In conversely, you might think, if you want to avoid misreading Cavell, you have to see that his vocabulary is inflected in a Cartesian register and not a Kantian register. So exactly the opposite moral from the one I drew about McDowell. Those might seem like a bunch of reasonable conclusions from what I've said in previous classes. Now let's see what happens as we look at McDowell and Cavell. So we've just looked at McDowell. We've seen how McDowell uses criteria. Now we want to see how Cavell employs the notion of criteria in the context of exactly the same issue, which is given that someone is pretending to be in pain, how should the concept of a criterion be deployed in this context? How is it deployed by Wittgenstein? So let's leave quotation two. Only certain eventualities will count as someone's not being in pain. Circumstances, namely, in which we will say he's feigning or rehearsing or hoaxing. Why such circumstances? What differentiates such circumstances from those in which he is said to be clearing his throat, responding to a joke, etc.? Just that, for he's rehearsing, or he's feigning, or it's a hoax, etc. To satisfy us as explanations for his not being in pain, what he is feigning must be precisely pain. What he's rehearsing must be the part of a man in pain. The hoax depends upon his simulating pain, etc. These circumstances are ones in appealing to which, in describing which, we retain the concept in question here of pain, whose application these criteria determine. What are criteria for Cavell? They determine the application of the concept. How does that differ from what we said before? Well, before we wanted to know, it was an epistemic question that we were appealing to criteria answer. How do we know we are vindicated in asserting, blah, blah, blah? That is, it's the Cartesian question of when do we get to say he's in pain? The right answer to the question is he's in pain. That's what criteria were to answer. Cavell's saying they show us when it's appropriate to employ the concept. And if we want to understand what Richard is doing, when Richard is pretending to be in pain, we're not going to be able to describe what Richard's doing without it's going through the concept of pain. We haven't simply misimplied, any more than if we want to characterize a dream of sitting in front of a fireplace in a dressing gown. We need the concepts of fireplace and dressing gown to characterize such a dream. That is, if we want to understand how it is that we can have that kind of a content, which is the character of the kind of seeming that's at issue, in this case, a pretense of pain, that concept has to be play. What the criteria are for are criteria that determine the appropriateness of the application of the concept in that sense. That is, on Cavell's reading, criteria aren't supposed to, in the first instance, deliver an answer to a Cartesian question about whether he's really in pain. It's got to be Cavell saying, criteria are not criteria for the existence of something. Rather, criteria are criteria that allow the question, is it pain he's in or not, to be one that it makes sense to ask. Criteria are criteria for the meaningful application of concepts, not for the expression of true claims with those concepts. Going back to the quotation, the circumstances are ones in appealing to which, in describing which, we retain the concept here of pain, whose application these criteria determine. And this means to me, in all such circumstances, he has satisfied the criteria we use for applying the concept of pain to others. It is because of that satisfaction that we know that he is feigning pain, that it's pain he's feigning, and that he knows what to do to feign pain. Criteria for something's being so. Not in the sense that they tell us of a thing's existence, but of something like its identity. They're criteria not of its being so, but of its being so. Actually, I don't know if you remember, but when I was first explaining the distinction between Cartesian, Kantian skepticism, one of the ways I put it, to allude to this passage of Cavell's. So, now let's put the Cavell next to the McDowell. At first blush, as I said before the break, they might appear simply to disagree. In cases of pretending to be in pain, McDowell says the criteria for pain are not satisfied, Cavell says they are. So we have a case of apparent disagreement here. And also, they both take this to be perfectly general. The issue isn't just one here about existence of other minds. It's a question about skepticism, what an appealing response to skepticism would look like, and what the role of an appeal to criteria in the context of such a response would be. But the second thing to notice is, given what I said at the beginning of the second half of this class about McDowell as he appeared in the exchange with Putnam, and Cavell as he appeared in the exchange with Kripke, their roles now seem to be reversed. That is, if you want to understand how the term criteria is functioning in McDowell, you have to see its functioning in a Cartesian register. If you want to see how the term criteria is functioning in Cavell, you have to see it's a Kantian register. They only disagree if they mean the same thing by the term. They don't mean the same thing by the term, first of all. Second of all, I think that each agree with the point the other is making using the term the way he is. It's a deeper reason for saying they don't disagree, which I haven't really fully vindicated yet. But their positions are reversed. McDowell's use of the criteria is inscribed in a Cartesian register. That means the question that's settled, according to McDowell, simply adopting the usage of the people he's criticizing. This is relatively early McDowell, by the way. I think that matters. The question that's settled according to him, if criteria are satisfied, is one concerning the truth of a claim. I say he's in pain. You want to know, is he in pain or is he pretending? Which is true? It's that Cartesian question of, given the appearance might look like that, is it true that he's really in pain? Or, the question is settled, is the existence of something. It's an ontological question. Given that the appearance is one in pain, how do I know that what's going on at the level of being corresponds to that he is really in pain? It's a question of, for McDowell, borrowing Cavell's distinction, for McDowell, criteria for something's being so, or someone's being in pain. Thirdly, another way of putting this, is that for McDowell, the question that's an issue in the adjudication of a question of criteria is a question of the reality of a phenomenon. Truth, being, reality. Those are the marks of a Cartesian question that we're trying to adjudicate. For Cavell, I'm suggesting criteria are here operating at a Kantian level. That's what's, just like with H.H. Price and C.I. Lewis, that's what's causing a whole set of vocabulary to shift its significance. And therefore, for there not to be an engagement where there's an apparent engagement at the level of terminology. Because he's operating at a Kantian level. The question settled according to Cavell, if criteria are satisfied, is not, he's quite explicit here, one concerning the truth of a claim, but one concerning its purport. We could ask, you know, in connection with Cavell, we say, you know, are the criteria for pain satisfied? You know, what does his behavior represent or purport him to be in? What kind of state? Pain. And that's true, whether he's pretending to be pain or whether he is in pain. So just like Kant is wondering, what does it so much as take to have an experience of dreaming or perceiving such and such? You know, what does it take for our experience to be less than a dream? To be more than less than a dream? Here we have Cavell asking, what kinds of concepts must we have and how must they apply for there to be a question to arise about whether it's pain that he's pretending or actually feeling? Pretending to feel or actually feeling. So, as I put it, a question of the purport. Another way of putting this is that for Cavell, the question is not concerning the existence of something that falls under a concept, but the applicability of the concept itself. What vindicates, what makes it legitimate to use this concept here? To speak meaningfully. That is, the issue here, as always in Kant, is first an issue of intelligence, the conditions of intelligibility, not veridicality. Or, third way of putting it, we could say it's not a question concerning the reality of the phenomenon, but its possibility. So, there's a number of issues here. Let me flag one, which I'm not going to talk about, but which I don't want to deny. One is there's an exegetical issue about how to read Wittgenstein. Wittgenstein appeals to criteria. And if you take criteria to be criteria for your being vindicated when you assert an epistemological claim, that's one way to understand what Wittgenstein's doing in appealing to criteria, the level at which he's engaging the Cartesian skeptic. If you take criteria to be, as Cavell does, criteria for the legitimate application of concepts, that's a very different way to understand how he's coming in. In fact, he's not yet directly addressing the Cartesian skeptic at all. He's rather making a move in a Kantian register. If he's directly addressing anyone, it's a Kantian skeptic. It's somebody like Kripke, who's asking the question, how can I so much as mean pain rather than claim? When I claim someone other than that. If there's a skeptic in the offering that we were addressing here, that's who it should be. Now, Cavell thinks, and I think he's right to think Wittgenstein thinks, as is true of Kant, that the interest in operating a Cartesian Kantian register is ultimately also to address the Cartesian skeptic. But as Cavell puts it, given his preoccupations, I think somewhat misleadingly. Criteria are bound to seem disappointing. What he means by that is they, questions about which criteria point themselves don't yield a direct answer to the Cartesian skeptic, who Cavell just calls the skeptic. So there's an exegetical question about Wittgenstein. When he talks about criteria, does he understand appeal to be criteria to be one in which he's immediately addressing a Cartesian epistemological question? Or is he first broaching a Kantian question about the conditions of the intelligible application of concepts? That's an exegetical question about Wittgenstein. They can't both be right about that, I think, unless Wittgenstein is incredibly clear what he's doing. I think only one of them could be right about that. And I'll just go on record without arguing for, I think Cavell is right about that issue. I don't see that actually the mature McDowell needs to disagree with that. That is, the mature McDowell, who wrote Mind and World, and it couldn't be more interested in Kantian skepticism. There is no one more interested in Kantian skepticism now alive than he. Could say, given how I'm using the word criteria in that essay, that is adopting the employment of the terminology the people I was arguing with were using, I said exactly what I should say. Doesn't need to retract anything in the essay in order to also be able to agree that, well, if we're reading Wittgenstein, we want to see what he's doing. Perhaps it's helpful to see Wittgenstein as thinking, as I now do in Mind and World, that the best way to address the Cartesian skeptic is to see Cartesian skepticism, as he puts it there, as an inept and inchoate response to a deeper philosophical anxiety of a Kantian variety. And the engagement with that Kantian problematic is going to be a more satisfying engagement with what goes wrong with skepticism, and then one could see criteria and the appeal to them understood Cavell's way as part of that task. So I don't see actually that McDowell needs to be very threatened by the fact that he's wrong about this exegetical issue. But I do think they can't both be right about that. Most one of them can be, and I'm just flatly and dogmatically asserting. I think Cavell is just because we don't have time for huge drafts of Wittgenstein interpretation here. The more interesting issue here, in the initial apparent disagreement, the more interesting issue for the purposes of our class, in the initial apparent disagreement between Cavell and McDowell, where McDowell is saying, apparently, criteria not satisfied, if someone's pretending to be in pain, and Cavell saying, criteria are satisfied, if the kind of pretending it is pretending to be in pain, that is, it's pain behavior that's at issue. The more interesting issue is there a philosophical disagreement here? Aside from the exegetical issue, which way Wittgenstein's using the word. In terms of philosophical substance, are they disagreeing about something? And there, I think the answer is no. I think the point McDowell is making, using criteria the way he's using, Cavell can agree with. And the point Cavell is making, using criteria the way he's using it, McDowell can agree with. And in fact, they're both criticizing the same view for the same reasons. They're simply employing the term differently. One is remaining with a Kantian grammar, a Cartesian grammar on the term, and then drawing the conclusion that we simply have to have a way of giving up on the highest common factor conception in order to avoid skepticism. The other is employing the term in a Kantian level and saying, at this level, as a question of intelligibility, the Cartesian question lapses. Now, this raises a puzzle about Cavell. Last class, I was arguing that Cavell misunderstands Kripke because Cavell seems to think the only thing skepticism can be is Cartesian skepticism. So he simply cannot see what Kripke's doing because it doesn't fit the earmarks of Cartesian skepticism. Now I'm arguing that you don't understand Cavell, and that he doesn't really disagree with McDonald here, unless you see that he's employing the term criteria in a Kantian register, rather than a Cartesian register. So you might think I'm contradicting myself. I don't think there's a formal logical contradiction in those two claims, but they don't sit very well with each other. Here's what I think about that. I'll just say this quickly, because we're running out of class here. So lots of things are going to get said quickly now. What I think about that is that Cavell does see, he doesn't have the vocabulary for putting it this way, but Cavell does see that Wittgenstein's encounter with Cartesian skepticism, in this sense, like Kant's on the reading of Kant I would favor, and I was outlining a few hours ago in this room, Wittgenstein's encounter with Cartesian skepticism, or his treatment of it, has the character of a certain sort of indirection. He doesn't go in by accepting the terms of the Cartesian problematic and saying, here's how we can claw our way out of the veil of perception, even given the highest common factor conception. Rather, he asks the question about what it takes to so much as be able to employ our concepts. What does it take to so much as be able to have experience? What does it take for something to so much as count as a case of perceiving someone's in pain? But the thought is that clarity about that is going to yield a situation in which the Cartesian question can't get off the ground in the way it wants to. So Cavell, I think, does see that there's a transition to, in my vocabulary, a Kantian register in the treatment of Cartesian skepticism. He has his own way of putting this. Quotation 3 on the handout, in the claim of reason, becomes clear that this is part of his interest in the distinction between Austinian and Wittgensteinian criteria that we were talking about last class. Is it last class? Yeah, last class. So that if you're concerned with Austinian criteria, you're concerned with, is it really a goldfinch? Do you have sufficient grounds for asserting it's a goldfinch? What becomes clear is if you're pressing a question about Wittgensteinian criteria for Cavell, the question in the first instance turns into a question about how it is that your experience can so much as have a certain kind of a shape. How it is that we can have, as it were, a relation to objects überhaupt, as he puts it. Cavell goes on right after he says this, a couple pages later, to quote four passages from the investigations. I've given them to you, 4 through 6. Only of a living human being and what resembles behaves a living human being can one say. It has sensations, it sees, and so forth. What has to be accepted is, one could say, forms of life. What so much as gives us the idea that living beings, things, feel. The human body is the best picture of the human soul. These are all cases in which Wittgenstein is, if you will, working at a Kantian register. The question isn't here, how can I know something's a living human being? The question has to do, in each case, if you will, with the application of certain fundamental concepts. What it is that can so much as give us the idea that such and such a way of schematizing appearances is appropriate, to put in a Kantian idiom. And Cavell is concerned to emphasize that's the level at which Kant is working. This is connected, I'm sorry, Wittgenstein is working. Interesting slip. So this is connected with what Cavell means when he says over and over again, criteria are disappointing. If you want criteria to immediately settle a question against the Cartesian skeptic, they will seem to fall short. They're supposed to. But the thing that Cavell is blind to, and the blindness that comes out so vividly in the encounter with Kripke, I think, is that although he sees that there's this move to this other register in the treatment of skepticism in Wittgenstein, and I think also Kant, though I don't think he sees that. I think he's a rather Cartesian reading of Kant. He doesn't see the thing that I tried to make vivid for you early in the class in the class on CILOs. Namely that, if you're working within a Kantian problematic, and things, you don't tell the story right. If you try to tell the story about how we can so much as have contentful thought about objects, and it starts to seem to go wrong, as it threatens to for Lewis, as it starts looking very hard to tell the story about how concepts can so much as apply, he thinks he needs external constraint. He thinks external constraint has to be external to the sphere of the conceptual every way. That starts looking like it needs a certain kind of input from sensibility itself, which is threatening to fall into the myth of the given. So we need a kind of constraint that comes from the quality of experience without coming from the individual moments. So we need Qualia. But it's a problem about how we're going to distinguish Qualia from Kant. And we've got a story in which we're trying to deliver a Kantian account. But it's threatening to fall apart. What happens if it falls apart? Then we have Kantian skepticism. Then we have a worry about, of a sort that we saw in the philosophy of language case in Kripke, with how it is that we can so much as have determinative thought, determinatively substantive empirical experience. How much in the philosophy of language case with Kripke, how much we can so much, how is it so much as possible that we can mean this rather than that? Cavell doesn't officially acknowledge the possibility of a shape of skepticism of that form. Skepticism always means for him Cartesian skepticism. But even though he doesn't officially acknowledge it, I think it actually comes out in many places in the Claim of Reason. And I'm just choosing one example here, which is quotation 8. And what I want to say about quotation 8 is you can see him doing much more quickly something that McDowell is doing somewhat more carefully and slowly in respect to a different philosophical example. In the middle of the essay, Singular Thought and the Extent of Inner Space. That is an essay. McDowell's trying to show you how you can start with a Cartesian problem about a certain kind of self-standing inner realm that's sealed off by the highest common factor assumption. And how if you think that through, that collapses into a Kantian problem. And you can see Cavell doing something like that much more quickly here and not really pausing over it. And I think there's a number of passages like this in Cavell. So here's a way of saying it. So the kind of claim I'm making about Cavell, you might put like this. He's such a good reader of Wittgenstein, just at the textual level, that he can't help but register the fact that Wittgenstein is interested in Kantian skepticism. But because he thinks that skepticism is supposed to be something with a Cartesian shape, he doesn't attach the significance he might to these passages where he himself is expounding Wittgenstein. So, here's quotation 8. To withhold or hedge our concepts of psychological states from a given creature on the ground that our criteria cannot reach to the inner life of the creature is specifically to withhold the source of my idea that living beings are things that feel. So now, if we start to have criteria lapse for us, where criteria are not Cartesian criteria for existence, but as he calls them, Wittgensteinian criteria for the application of concepts, or we might say Kantian criteria for being able to so much as apprehend something as an expressive body. If I specifically withhold the source of my idea, the living beings are things that feel, is to withhold myself, to reject my response to anything as a living being, to blank so much as my idea of anything as having a body. To describe this condition as one in which I do not know, am not certain of the existence of other minds, is empty. Yes, as I keep saying, Kantian skepticism turns out not to be a problem of knowledge anymore. It's much more extreme than that. There is now nothing there of the right kind to be known. There is nothing to read from that body. Nothing the body is of. It does not go beyond itself. It expresses nothing. It does not so much as behave. There is no body left to manifest consciousness or unconsciousness. It is not dead, but inanimate. It hides nothing. My problem is that no longer that my words can't get past his body to him. The problem now is there is nothing for them to get to. They can't even reach as far as my body. The signs are dead. Merely working them out loud doesn't breathe life into them. Things quite clear here is exactly the analog problem in other minds that Kripke has. with respect to language. The problem isn't any longer for Kripke and philosophy of language. It starts out looking like, how can we know when there's adding or clouding? But by the time Kripke's done, the problem is, how can a sign ever be adding or clouding? How can ever be more than a merely dead mark that normatively constrains you one way around another? Here, too, Cavell is realizing that if you understand criteria to be playing the role that they're playing, and they lapse, then your problem isn't going to be, how can I know, given that he seems to be in pain, he's really in pain? How could his body so much as ever count as expressing pain? His body winds up in the same place as Kripke's marks and noises do, as merely dead, as incapable of being determinate vehicles of expression. It's quite nice because he's actually paraphrasing some of the same remarks that Kripke does to make his philosophy of language point. The signs are dead, we can't breathe life into them. And you know, that metaphor can apply whether the sign in question is a signpost, a semantic sign, or a contentful human expression of the bodily state. Pain, anger, and so forth. So, this is a clear case for me of Cavell, in fact, articulating the Kantian skeptical problem, but not seeing, as it were, its significance within the context of Wittgenstein's treatment of skepticism. Not seeing, for instance, this is something that Wittgenstein would count as a kind of skepticism, a more radical form of skepticism, thinking through of Cartesian skepticism. So it's not that McDowell is blind to the fact. So when we say Cavell uses criteria in a Kantian register, McDowell uses criteria in a Cartesian register, that's why there seems to be disagreement here when there isn't. This is a much more complicated case than Lewis and Price. We have Lewis and Price talking about the given. One is really just locked into a Kantian problematic. The other one's just locked into a Cartesian problematic. And, you know, they're in a sense passing each other by while seeming to discuss the same thing. The relationship between Cavell and McDowell here is much more complicated. It's not that McDowell isn't interested in the Kantian problematic and doesn't see Cartesian skepticism as something that requires a kind of thinking through that leads to reflection on Kantian issues. But he doesn't see that the kind of appeal to criteria that Wittgenstein is engaged in is already an exemplification of that sort of treatment. So that the secondary literature that's construed as an epistemological notion is already missing how early Wittgenstein's refusal to engage with the Cartesian as own grounds is taking place. Conversely, although Cavell misses the idea that skepticism is a term that could denote a variety of skepticism that doesn't have a Cartesian shape at all, it's not because he's completely blind to the issue of Kantian skepticism. He simply doesn't see the significance and the centrality it has for Wittgenstein, or for that matter, for somebody like Kripke or McDowell, in the eventual treatment of Cartesian skepticism. So it's very hard to say, if one would say, what exactly do Cavell and McDowell agree about in substance? I think there is some disagreement. I think there's some things that you see the other doesn't see. But it's not so easy to say now. One has to think very carefully. One has to put the points very carefully. And there isn't any neutral philosophical vocabulary to put this in. If one tries to say something like, well, they both think that skepticism is blah, blah, blah. Or they disagree because one of them thinks criteria this and the other one thinks criteria that. That's already likely to be completely inadequate as an expression of their points of agreement or disagreement. Because what we need to be careful about is, well, what do we mean by criteria? What are criteria for? What kind of philosophical problematic are they engaging in? What would count as the answer to that question? And who is it supposed to satisfy? And how? And similarly for all the other terminology that's at issue here. So let me just step back and summarize some things we've seen in the course, and then I'll pause and let anyone who wants to ask a question. We started at the beginning of the course by my trying to give you a sort of perspicuous overview at least two varieties of skepticism. which I call Cartesian and Kantian. And as I said at the beginning, I'll just repeat this now, I don't take these to be exhaustive. I think it's just helpful to have two cases to begin with before you try to do three. I think there are other varieties of skepticism that have other forms. And I was one of the things I've suggested is if you have that perspicuous overview of even the distinction between these two varieties, it can be of tremendous philosophical benefit in a variety of different ways. With the first couple of handouts in the class where I gave you the different variants in Cartesian skepticism, the different variants in Kantian skepticism, I was suggesting a first possible kind of philosophical benefit, which is that you can have a philosophical problem that is exactly the same shape, but is wrapped in a completely different clothing, and think it's a completely different problem. And it's extremely helpful to realize when your philosophical problem has the same shape. It's extremely helpful to realize that although you thought that you changed the subject from mind to language, you changed the assumption from thinking to assertion and so forth, but actually this story about criteria still retains the highest common factor conception, and therefore involves a generically Cartesian account of what the constraints on knowledge are. That's very helpful to recognize that kind of feature in your thinking. Because then you can start seeing whether you're really making progress or not. And you can see that if it doesn't work over here, it's not going to work over there if the problem has exactly the same form. So that's one benefit. A second kind of benefit is it can allow you to see cases where you think you're talking about the same thing. They can be quite different. So it's easy with respect to each of those paired variants in philosophy of perception, otherwise philosophy of language, to think these are just two ways of saying the same thing, and not realize that the philosophical problem is itself undergoing a change in shape as we force the one kind of question rather than the other. And this is connected to something that we've seen, which is that you can have passages like Lewis's and Price's that appear to be about exactly the same thing and have a very different philosophical substance, or Putnam and McDowell. That is, passages that can actually be making the opposite point with exactly the same words. And hence cases where you have, as I put it earlier, merely apparent agreement in philosophy. I think there are many of these, and I think this is one of the sources of it. And then, thirdly, you can have cases like the one I tried to give you with Kripke and Cavell last time, and the one I tried to just give you today with McDowell and Cavell. You can have also cases of merely apparent disagreement. That is, you can have philosophers who seem quite concerned to disagree with what the other philosopher is saying. And given how they're using the words, they're right to stick that negation. But it doesn't actually mean you have a case of disagreement. Of course, sometimes you do. But one of the things that can happen is, in fact, if you got clear about how this vocabulary was working in a Cartesian register, and this in a Kantian register, you could have a case, as I think you do with McDowell and Cavell, where they would actually be in a position to agree with everything the other person is saying on an appropriately perspicuous and transparent regimentation of how they're using the words with which they're saying it. Finally, something I wanted to talk about more, we can take it up in discussion if you want, but I'll just flag it. I've said a little bit about it when we talked about McDowell. Once you have this overview of varieties of skepticism, there's a further question you can ask, which is, how are they related? So, for instance, with respect to these two, how are Cartesian and Kantian skepticism related? And I think seeing what some of the major philosophers have thought about that is a good way into the center of the most important and difficult aspects of their thought. If you ask that question about a Kant, a Hegel, a Frege, a Heidegger, a Sellers, a McDowell, a Strauss, and an Evans. Those are, I'm trying to get a pretty eclectic group here. Those are very different philosophers. But with each of them, if you ask that question about them, I think it takes you right to the heart of what's most interesting about each. I'm not saying they all agree in their answer to that question, but I think it is the mark of many of the most interesting philosophers that they actually have a view about that question. And sometimes, you know, as in the case of, say, Frege, as it comes up with respect to certain particular forms of philosophy, say the relation between sense and reference. sometimes with other philosophers like Kant or Wittgenstein, they're concerned with the number of different forms at once, or McDowell, most strikingly. but nonetheless, by asking the question, what is the relation between these? What do they take the relation to be? You're asking a question that takes you to some very central issues of philosophy that are easily missed in trying to understand those philosophers. And I think part of what, in my view, makes some of the most interesting philosophers as interesting as they are, and here I think Kant, Wittgenstein, and McDowell are particularly clear cases, and McDowell is partly interested in this connection between Kant and Wittgenstein, so it's not a thoroughly coincidental list, is exactly their view about this question. What's the relationship between Cartesian and Kantian skepticism? They're not going to take them just to be two things that happen to get called skepticism. They're going to take them to be things where the one is a form of philosophical worry or bind, which thought through has an internal relation to the other. Certain features that are initially coming to you in one form become more articulate, but also more clearly hopeless, and in a sense more perplexing. I tried to bring out just how unstable and perplexing Kantian skepticism is in the context of talking about Kripke's variant of it, philosophy of language, because I think Kripke is one of those rare philosophers who's, on the one hand, sort of attracted to, but on the other hand, very lucid about just what a boggle it is that he's heading towards. And also think that it's only clarity about the philosophical confusion in its radicalized form that will really lead to clarity with respect to the more inchoate problems that first come up as the form, in the form of Cartesian skepticism. So, finally, then, to say the final benefit, that comes from having these distinctions, I think you can ask interesting questions about interesting philosophers. You can ask, what do they think about this? And you can start having how you read them organized around this principle. So, to sum up, the advantages are, you can see that you've got the same problem again. You can see that where you think you've got the same problem again, you haven't. There are cases where you can see where you think you really agree with someone, you don't. Or you think you really disagree with someone, you don't. And finally, sometimes even, I think this happens in Putnam a bit in the things we're reading, you can see you don't even agree with yourself in ways that you think you do. And you can see whether you really do agree with the really interesting philosophers like Kant or Wittgenstein or McDowell by getting clear what it is they think. So those are some of the benefits I hope would come out of this class. I'm purposely ending a little bit early so that there's time for questions.
Would it be the case to say, I mean, the Kantian problematic is in some sense more fundamental than the...
That's a claim.
Yeah, I know, I know. But would it be the case that, say, if you... It's stupid to say that you can solve the Kantian problematic, but let's just use that term. If you manage to solve the Kantian problematic, will the result then be that the Cartesian problematic becomes uninteresting, or...
Well, that, there's a philosophical claim to that thing. I mean, let's first be careful. I've tried very hard, I don't know whether I flagged this, but let me flag it now. I've tried very hard to set up the terminology. So the terminology itself does not load the answer to that question. Mm-hmm. That is, I've tried to give you a way of identifying whether something's Cartesian skepticism and whether something's Kantian skepticism. So you can do that in terms of the features, in terms of the issues that are at stake, in terms of the dialectical relation between the concepts of knowledge, doubt, certainty, generality, and so forth in the one case, and so on for the other case. So that, you know, we could just agree, you know, as a matter of description, when we go in and look at Price, yeah, this is a case of someone worried about a Cartesian problematic. This is a case of someone worried about a Kantian problematic. And I want that terminology to be anchored in features of descriptions of those philosophers that are sufficiently neutral, that does not itself in any way prejudge the answer to the question, what's the relationship between Cartesian and Kantian skepticism? So it should be possible to, as it were, agree on how to sort things and say, this is Cartesian, this is Kantian, or this seems to be some strange mixture of both, and then we can talk about what the significance of that mixture is. There ought to be possible to agree on how to sort things with respect to those cases, while remaining at least initially perfectly neutral about how they're related. You know, one view you could have is, and they have nothing to do with each other. Another view you could have is, they have something to do with each other, but it takes a complicated story. A third view you could have is, Cartesian skepticism is something a lot of people are interested in, but it's really stupid and boring. And Kantian skepticism is the interesting issue. Or the converse view. I know people who hold both the first view about Cartesian and people who hold the opposite. I gave this talk to a bunch of philosophers, and Daniel Dennett got up and said, I really liked your talk. I completely agree with everything you said. And I did say when he said that, now that worries me. But the reason he thought he completely agreed with it was he thought I was drawing a distinction between two kinds of philosophical problematic. And they're both out there. And the first one's really boring, and the second one's the important question. What we should do is just get over the first questions, because they're just dumb. And the second ones are the ones that contemporary naturalism is trying to answer, the ones he's trying to answer with his work on the intentional stance. And those are the interesting ones. The fact that he could appropriate that way does bring out something, which is the initial classification is, in a sense, as it were, neutral with respect to how you answer the question. What's the relationship between Cartesian and Kantian? I want that question to be formulated in such a way that the very formulation of it doesn't yield an answer. It yields a question, which we can see different people as giving different answers to. But now, what's right is that some of the thinkers in our class have a view about that, the three along the lines that you were sketching. But that's extremely substantive philosophical view. That's not something I think that falls out of the distinction.
No, but
that's something that needs to be claimed. And then the three thinkers that I think are at issue here are Cavell, Wittgenstein, and McDowell, and I think they all have actually slightly different views about that. Mm-hmm. I could say something about one or another of them. But we would have to then go into detail about how they each think that a transition to Kantian skepticism is an essential resource in reply to Cartesian skepticism. And a further question is it not only a necessary transition, but is it a sufficient transition? I think Kant thinks that both, that is, he thinks, in order to answer the Cartesian skeptic, first you need to get clear what's wrong with the generalized Humean skeptic, or it's called the Kantian skeptic. And once you've done that, the response to Cartesian skepticism just falls out. That was, I think, part of your question. And that's what Kant thinks. I don't think that's what Wittgenstein thinks.
No, but that was especially
so we'd have to go into more detail about each of
these. Yeah, but that was especially having, say, this remark of McDowell's, I think it's at page 143 in my novel, where he sort of says that he wants to reach a point where you can just shrug your shoulder to skeptical worries. For me, it seems to give some sense to an idea that if you manage to exercise the Kantian problematic, you reach a position where... But perhaps this is a misreading of McDowell. Or it... You must add a lot of pretext to...
Well, there is some thought like this in McDowell, I think. If you could show that once you've got something set up that has a Cartesian form, and you think through what you're committed to, and you realize it runs into the kinds of problems that Kantian skepticism does, and you realize why those collapse into their own way and why, then you're in a position to see. But that's a lot of work. When Rorty talks about shrugging the shoulders, Rorty just means, you know, people start making certain noises and you shrug your shoulders. Whereas this is the conception of a certain kind of philosophical work that entitles you to the shrugging of the shoulders. Then once you've seen all of that, Once you can see a view has this shape, you're in a position to see. Now, that's not a well-formulated Tao. That's not to be distinguished from a genuine doubt about something you might be wrong about, in the sense where the content has been given to the sense in which you might be wrong. So there certainly is, therefore, in McDowell, a sharing of Kant's idea that if we can show the character of the internal relationship between Kant and Cartesian skepticism, and we can give the right kind of treatment of Kantian skepticism, then we will be able to retrospectively look at a problem that has an incipiently Cartesian shape, entitle ourselves to no longer be troubled by it. But it's worth saying that both Kant and McDowell are also clear, just to make it clear how little this shoulder shrugging does for you. I mean, the first sentence of the Critique of Pure Reason is, there are these questions which, although reason does not have the powers to answer, it can also not help asking. It belongs to the very constitution of reason itself that it will ask these questions and find them to be apparently like that. So Kant's view isn't that the skeptical questions are going to stop, but that, you know, once you're fully equipped with the resources of critique, you are in a position to, as it were, go back through in each form in which a skeptical problematic raises itself and see why it doesn't, as it were, deprive you of your vindication to entitlement, to claim to know in the way that appears to. And similarly, McDowell's quite clear at one point in Mind and World that he doesn't take what he's doing to be bringing an end to philosophy, as he puts it. But he does, but so, it's a kind of, so the shoulder struggling is a certain, as it were, structural entitlement. There comes a certain kind of work. But I do think even there, again, I'm just saying lots of things dogmatically. I'm not pretending to earn any of these claims about Connor McDowell or now Wittgenstein. I'll just say what I think. I do think there's a big difference here, in a way, between Wittgenstein and these Kantians, in that although I think Wittgenstein is very interested in showing how Cartesian skepticism thought through turns into a Kantian problematic and the problems that that involves, for reasons that are he shares with Kant, as Wittgenstein thinks, as McDowell thinks he does. I think Wittgenstein also thinks you're not going to get a satisfying treatment of these problems unless you have a very, very clear sense of what the initial transition to Cartesianism looks like. What is that first step? What's the moment at which we have equipped ourselves to something like the highest kind of faculties? What's the moment at which we've gone from a specific question to a question about a generic object? What's the moment at which we're having something trying to function the way a best case is supposed to function in the Cartesian problematic? What does that initial entry look like? And unless we're extremely clear about, to borrow a phrase, what that initial trick in the conjuring game that seems utterly innocent looks like, and why it's not innocent, then all of this work is, in a sense, going to be wasted effort, because we're going to constantly still find ourselves stuck somewhere in the middle of this dialectic. So I think there's a tremendous kind of interest in Wittgenstein with mapping the topology of Cartesian skepticism for its own sake. Whereas if you have a sort of exclusively Kantian interest in treating the problem, then you're sort of not interested in Cartesian examples and how things start. What you want to do is, as it were, very quickly show, as Kripke, say, very quickly does in the philosophy language case, what the Kantian version of the problem is and just treat it in that form. And this is connected with, I think, it's looking to certain people, like some of what Wittgenstein's doing is kind of wasted effort. Why is he bothering with these, as it were, are going to look like sort of, you know, unclear, incipient versions of the philosophical problematic. You know, that's the bad part. So I think it's very common for people to think something like the rule-following sections. That's Wittgenstein when he's good. And these other parts where he gets hung up on all of these details, that's Wittgenstein sort of really failing to get to the good stuff. I think it's, If you have a sort of, as it were, exclusively Kantian view about the relationship between Cartesian kind of skepticism, then I think Wittgenstein is bound to look to you that way. Conversely, I think, you know, Cavell has a bit of the opposite problem. Cavell is extremely interested, to put it in Cavell's vocabulary, in the moment in which we depart from the ordinary. The moment in Wittgenstein Cavell likes so much. So Wittgenstein talks about bringing our words back from their metaphysical uses to their home and ordinary language. So he's going to particularly focus on those passages. And I think he's not a very good reader of something like the rule-following problematic. So that is, when Wittgenstein is really working through the commitments in such a way that they're bottoming out into something that has the shape of a Kantian form, Cavell acknowledges that you have such moments. There's a sense in which the last quotation I hand out is a sort of clear sort of exemplification of that. But something that sort of happens quickly. It isn't really accorded the kind of weight. I think it really has. So I don't think one necessarily has to draw the conclusion that one has to choose here. Either the shoulder-shrugging moment that a Kantian entitles himself to isn't sufficient, therefore it's not necessary in Wittgenstein's conception of what he's doing, or it is necessary and therefore it must be sufficient. I think those would be equally bad conclusions. And so, so I think something that McDowell is saying there, it seems to me, one could take on board. The question, I think, it seems to me a better way of putting the criticism you want to make of McDowell that would be one of a certain kind of omission in his conception of what the treatment of skepticism looks like, whereas you are framing it as a charge of commission. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I wonder if that charge isn't kind of misreading how he understands, you know, what it is that entitles him to the shrug of the soldier. I think it's an important idiom just because, you know, part of what McDowell's doing in that book, he's negotiating a lot of things, but one of the things he's negotiating is his relation to Rorty. And shoulder shrugging is a very important part of Rorty's understanding of how philosophical progress takes place. And in Rorty, the shoulder shrugging is a kind of thing that you allow yourself to feel entitled to do with very little philosophical work. You basically just notice, gee, thinking about these kinds of philosophical problems seems to get us into trouble. So let's stop doing it. Whenever that starts, let's just shrug our shoulders. And in fact, if any of you have ever heard Rorty talk, you know, this is an important part of his performance. You know, sometimes, you know, someone will ask, it's particularly fun watching Rorty give lectures in France because the questions are so long. So someone will get up and they'll ask a question for about 20 minutes about what Rorty thinks about presence and hunger. And then Rorty will sometimes just say, no, next question. But sometimes, he won't even say that. What Rorty will just do is go, and it's actually, you know, an important part, not just of his theory of his practice, but his practice, to simply shrug his shoulders. And see. Now, that's not the role of the gesture, as I understand it in McDowell. But if you hear it that way, if you hear it as, you know, as something which doesn't require the exorcism in order to achieve the clarity, to see that you're entitled to do that, but it's just sort of something you do because you realize, gee, this is leading to trouble. Well, that's not much better than the view of criteria he's criticizing here, which is actually a somewhat Rorty's view. So it's very, McDowell is very concerned that in shrugging our shoulders, we're not just actually acquiescing in a form of skepticism while pretending we're not interested. I think that's what he thinks about Rorty. Actually, what happens to Rorty is he winds up with extremely skeptical views. He claims to be free of skepticism, but unless you actually think through where skepticism goes wrong, you're not going to be free of it. You're just going to relabel the view while it still has the same shape. So I actually think it's a somewhat unfortunate way for McDowell to put what he's saying there, but that is how he puts it. But there are some footnotes, I think, in my world where he tries to distinguish himself from Rorty. Yeah, I think if you look at those, I think you'll see that the shoulder shrugging can't be of that sort if he wants to be able to be entitled to those footnotes. Well, thank you for those hardy survivors who are still in this room, thank you for your attention.
On behalf of the department, we would like to thank you for coming to Bergen.
It's a pleasure.